Let's return to our question then, which is, do we believe our moral vision has a future? How do we respond to this revolution if we do believe it has a future? How do we make that moral vision of the scriptures, the biblical narrative, how do we make it plausible to people? And that's what we just need to think about. And I want to suggest two things. First of all, if we need a better critique, as well as then going on to tell a better story of our own. And I think there are some things we could do better in terms of our critique. It does tend to be negative, doesn't it? And people can reasonably say, we keep hearing what you're against, what are you for? And we do get drawn into ad hominem disputes and cases, whereas we need to find ways of talking about the many as well as the few, about goods, values that serve the needs of the many and not the individuals who we're presented with constantly. And if we start fighting over individual cases, we'll just lose because we look mean and we're back to the old narrative of wanting to sit on the little people. And we can sound, suddenly we're all interested in religious freedom, aren't we? So that's the big issue of our day. And you could be forgiven if someone says, I think the only kind of freedom you people are really interested in is your own, if I'm honest. I don't hear you rooting for me when I was being put into one of these homes in the 60s. So you're back to that narrative. So I just think, can we make a better critique? And I think we can do in two ways. First of all, we could start with ourselves. That's the first bit. Let's start with us, the starvation diet, and come clean about it. That it's Gnostic, it's Platonic. We are not being truly biblical as biblical Christians in this area. We've allowed our shame to drive it to the edges of our own consciousness and our own culture. So let's come clean. It doesn't cost us anything to come clean with our culture. And to say in the 60s, the sexual revolution quite probably spoke truth to our power. And it said some things that we needed to hear. Sometimes we are oppressive. When I hear people talk about gay people, I think, that's harsh. That is harsh. And I'm not sure that you've really know the kind some of these folk that you're talking about. And we have sometimes been oppressive, judgmental, and many of us, perhaps most of us, have raised our young people in ignorance and shame. And we do find it hard to be honest about our sexual selves. So let's respond with humility. Let's own that and say where the sexual revolution forces us to face up to these uncomfortable truths about ourselves. Let's say thank you. Maybe God, as through Cyrus, spoke to us uncomfortable words. And also, where those in the revolution and drawn to it have simply showed kindness and care for the outsider, let's acknowledge it. Doesn't cost. We don't have to see this in black and white terms. Where someone's kind and good and want to see somebody do well and not be driven out, let's acknowledge that and thank God for it, and make a commitment to being truly biblical. So we could do a lot about that, but having owned up to some of our failures, in other words, we promised the world. Jesus said, I'll bring you life and life abundant. That was what we promised. And we didn't deliver in the area of sex and relationships. So having come clean about our failed promises, we're perhaps better equipped then to move on to look at the sexual revolution and to critique it in terms of its promises. In other words, I think the opportunity isn't to critique the sexual revolution in terms of what you think and say. Critique it in terms of what it says and offers and promises and holds out to people. And it's a much better way, that, of connecting with our culture, where we say, look, we own up, the starvation diet wasn't great, and we can see why the fast food diet looks so good, and we've got a lot to learn, and I've got stuff to learn from you, so keep talking, please. But also, we do see some things really differently, and you know, I'll own up some of our failed promises, but would you give us space? Can we create some space now to look at some of the promises of this revolution, see how it's delivering, because I think there are some issues there. And that gives us a way in, and there's so much we can talk about. And I'm just going to land on a couple of them, actually, but we could spend a couple of seminars on the failed promise of the sexual revolution. You could say, we brought our kids up on starvation diet. You pornographied childhood. That's what the sexual revolution did. It pornographied our children's entry into their experience of themselves as sexual beings. It objectified women. It made sex something that's self-serving rather than something that leads to true flourishing. And the Children's Commissioner last year, the government-appointed body for the welfare of kids, issued a report on the pornographication of childhood. And you know what they called the title? The title is, basically, pornography is everywhere. Because that pretty much summarizes childhood experience. You know, the Children's Commissioner, I heard her on an interview, she says, you know, you can talk about 80% have viewed it by this age and 90% that age and then the social class distinction and so on. But she said, cutting to the chase, basically, porn is everywhere in childhood. And, you know, when we get around to shipping our young people off to some awkward talk about sex at 14, they've been seeing stuff very often. And particularly the poorer you get, you know, the pornographication of child. So we could go there. We could talk about identity. We could, and in my book, The Big Ego Trip, I've tried to draw together the psychological evidence which shows how this self-fulfillment project has failed. This idea that we can define our own worth and significance from within has failed spectacularly. We're becoming more narcissistic, more self-absorbed, more insecure as this ideology has been rolled out in our culture the past 30, 40 years. I'll give you an example, a little experiment. If you randomize people to two groups or three groups, and in one you tell them to look at some of these, I'm special, I'm worthy, I attract people to me now, these positive statements, you know, about me. If you get them to meditate on these for 20, 30 minutes a day for 3 months, and the next group, they're asked to meditate on them as well, you get a pack of these cards, but you say, now what I want you to do is evaluate, how is this true of me and how isn't it true of me? See, different thing. And the third group gets the cards but no instructions. Okay. If you compare outcomes at 6 months, what do you find? And it's one of the experiments I look up in the book, The Big Ego Trip. Well, what you find is that the people who had low self-esteem, a low sense of self-worth, at the beginning of the study in group one, who got the cards and told to meditate positively on this, the people with low self-worth feel worse at the end. They're actually more depressed. They score lower on a range of psychological well-being measures. Why? Because it's hard to believe your own propaganda. And that's all it is. It's got no transcendent traction to it. You're naming yourself, you see. And that, in the end, is a psychological cul-de-sac that puts us on a treadmill of in trying to escape other people's naming of us. When we try to name ourselves, it leads to such insecurity. We become more vulnerable to other people's naming of us. So I'm gay, I'm straight, I'm this, I'm that. Identity politics is a way in which the world sells us the idea, you say who you are, but if that doesn't work, this is under the bonnet, this bit, we're only too ready to help tell you who you are. Use this cosmetic, look like this, bear yourself like that. we can help you. That's under the bonnet, because the front message is you. You say who you are. The world senses it doesn't work, which is why it has all the products ready to fill in the gap. So we could go there, and I didn't mean to go there, and I did, didn't I? But I just want to land on two areas, two fruitful ways in which we can critique the revolution. One, very briefly, sex. You'd think that this liberating revolution at least would deliver what sits at its core, sex, more sex. People, you know, you'd think people would have more sex now that the shackles of shame, of you and me and our shame culture has been lifted. Now, how's that project going? Are we having more and better sex? Well, Professor Spiegelhalter, who's the professor of statistics at Oxford University, has written a good little book, no, medium-sized book, called Sex by Numbers. And he's trying to say, you know, there are big statistical issues about, you know, science says and the latest survey says and in this area. And he tries to look at the methodological and summarize what the evidence tends to show. Okay? So lots of stuff in the book as a statistician writing. But he summarizes the frequency of having sex over the past few decades. Okay? And the question is, what's the average frequency of sex in the last 4 weeks? Okay, age 16 to 44. Not all men, like some of us. Age 16 to 44. What's the average number of times you had sex in the last month? And in 1990, the best survey data, population level data, said 5. 2004, 2010, 3. Why, he said, at this rate, no one will be having his sex at all by the year 2040. And I very much doubt that'll be the case, as does he. But it makes a point, and there's a big puzzle here. This sex-absorbed culture, which promises flourishing, freedom, we're having less sex overall, even in that age range. And there's no evidence that the quality, you know, it's not the quality now over quality. The army of agony ants and the data out there isn't quite so good, which is why I'm not showing it. But the data is all moving against that as well. We're not happier. This revolution isn't producing goods in the very area after which it's named. That's quite important for us to know that. But I want to move on quickly, because I think these are what we really need to think about if we say, has the revolution delivered its promises? Do you remember I said it promised freedom, equality, justice? And the word I want to put alongside those three words is kids. How's the revolution doing in terms of delivering freedom and justice for them? What it's done, of course, is it's produced a situation overall in which nearly one half of kids reach the age of 16 with two biological parents in the home. Only one half. The other half are in something different. And put that together with those divorce statistics and the cohabitation statistics I showed you earlier, and we have a landscape out there of instability in our children's lives of really significant magnitude. Now, they're very resilient kids, thankfully. But nevertheless, the toll of that is beginning to be seen. Well, the situation could be summarized in terms of its impact on kids like this. This is a study from the Brookings Institute, and which is a secular think tank, and Princeton University, a big review and conference they held of different family structures and how they affect kids. And this is a summary statement. Reams of social science and medical research convincingly show that children who are raised by their married biological parents enjoy better physical, cognitive, and emotional outcomes on average than children who were raised in other circumstances, other family structures. Now, the bottom line is that what they're saying is stability of a mother and father bound together in a covenant recognized by a community, supported by a community. They're just saying, kids like that. It's good for them. They flourish in that setting. And of course, the little word to get there is on average. On average. By the way, just about a month ago, I think it was, the Irish Growing Up in Ireland longitudinal study came out. Exactly the same finding, comparing different kinds of family structures. I'll keep going for the minute, my friend. Yeah. So what I suggest is that the instability of divorce is bad news for kids. Now, but before I go any further, I always make a big, on average, that's the word to look at there. Of course, some marriages are very bad for kids, individual marriages. And some non-traditional families, such as same-sex parents, some can be very good for kids. This isn't about it's not about somebody here who says, you're talking about me here. You know, I'm a single dad or a single mum, and this hurts because it seems to be saying to me. And what I'd say is, on average, there are some wonderful, wonderful single mums and dads out there that you'll know and that will be in your congregation, you hope and pray for, if we're opening our doors to the world. And we mustn't use these data to drive any doubt, but neither must we let people's individual stories prevent us from saying, but the reality is that on average, kids love stability. And what we need as a community, as a society, is to work together to find a language, to find ways, values even, that create stability for kids. And my simple point is that marriage is a great, great source of that. It's a great source of what I'm going to call moral capital. Moral capital. What marriage does is it creates in a community values which work well for the poorest members of that society. Because marriage is about commitment, keeping promises, maturity, being faithful, about sticking with situations when they don't turn out so well as you'd hoped, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. These are deep virtues that produce goodness amongst us. And so moral capital, and I was rather pleased with myself, I thought I'd invented this term. It's always a problem as you Google it and you find that, you know, it's been around. But what you've got is, we all know what capital is. Capital is what enables you, it's resources in a community, resources in a society that enable you to make more, to do more things. So if you want to work in the business, you need more money, you need some capital to get you going. Okay? And social scientists talk about social capital similarly. Now, what's social capital? Social capital is the number of connections between people in a community that allows them to have reciprocal relationships, to look after one another, to give and take, to barter, to work in ways that work for the common good, they'd say, you see. That's social capital, and you can measure it and do experiments with social capital, that the amount of bonds there are between people. But what this idea of moral capital is, it says, okay, over here I've got 100 people with X amount of social capital. There's so much connections between them. And over here I've got 100 people with X amount of social capital, so many connections between them. Now, what stops the community over here, quite a few people, exploiting those connections between people for their own ends, you see? Fraudsters and pranksters and selfish and fake. What stops them exploiting that social capital? Moral capital. Moral capital is the values that are embedded in those relationships and the institutions that support those values. And so what moral capital does is it creates in a community virtues which bind that community together and work for the interests of its most vulnerable members, particularly its kids. And so what marriage does, you see, in this binding together way, is something that cohabitation doesn't do. What you find with cohabitation, these are data from the Marriage Foundation, is that if you were born and your parents got married before you were born today, the chances of them being separated 10 years later is still 25%. So I'm a little kid come into the world. Chances of my living with my mum in 10 years' time, as it usually is 25% still. But if I'm born into the world and my parents are not married, but then they get married in the next year, okay, so they think they'll do the right thing. But my chances now are 50%. And if my parents never get married, the chances of them being separated are 75% 10 years later. Because the simple genius of marriage is that it binds men into their responsibilities for the children they help to bring into the world. And this gift of God is life for the world because it brings life to its most vulnerable. Now, if you're a social scientist here, you'd love to have a big debate with me now about directions of causality here. You know, looking at the data, is it the kind of people who get married who would look after their kids and be more stable anyway? Or does marriage have a magic of its own and create a kind of a expectations that people meet? How are you going to answer that? The only way you're going to answer it is you randomize children. One is you go to a family where your parents are cohabit, and you go to one where you don't. It's the only way you're going to unconfound that complex question. Nobody's going to do that. So the question will never be entirely answered. But with more sophisticated statistical techniques now and longitudinal data, I'm not unbiased here. So, you know, we all bring biases to this. But my looking at the data is that on balance, the data are beginning to emerge that marriage itself has a magic of its own. It's an extra ingredient. Of course, certain personality types are more likely to get married. But even these muddy data show that marriage has a magic of its own. Friends, I would just say, use common sense. That a community which values marriage and has institutions that support marriage and publicly owns marriage is going to be a community that values promise keeping, mutual support, looking out for the little ones, deferring gratification for long-term outcomes, because we're not going to go on a holiday this year because I want to send my boy to university. You see, it spawns all of those virtues. It's a moral capacity builder. And it is life for the world, for the most vulnerable. And so what we're beginning to find is a language now of equality and fairness and justice. So we say to someone, I understand, when you talk about this guy, your nephew, I understand that. I'll connect it now with another story. I'll say, one of my pastors, Ed Shaw, written a book, Plausibility Project, he's same-sex attracted. I've walked with Ed. I know the struggles he has. I know lots of Christian girls. No one worried about any of this for all our single women who wanted to honour God by not marrying an unchristian. I know lots of Christian women who've worked through some of the struggle of this as well. And so I don't want to devalue what you're talking about in your nephew. I understand that sense of fairness, but if you bear with me, we see it differently. We just look at this through a different lens. And what I see in Ed, my pastor, is that he disciples his attractions. He shepherds his attractions, not in a way that fulfills him, but he shepherds them for the common good. He wants to build the kind of virtues that serve everybody. Most of all, he wants to honour marriage. Because what we believe is, we believe in equality, fairness, justice, but we think that what delivers it to the most vulnerable people is this gift of God called marriage. And that's why we're for it. And we're not asking you to agree with us, but don't, you can't claim a monopoly on justice and fairness and equality. That's our language too. And we've got, friends, I know I'm a bit preachy, aren't I, but you'll have to forgive me. Because I do care about this. I think we've got to recover the Lord's heart for kids here. You know, God loves kids. And the kids who are strewn in care and in fatherless wastelands, you know, it moves his heart. And, you know, O.M. Backer, I don't know whether you've heard of his book, When Children Became Persons, church historian, When Children Became Persons, he says, we've forgotten how great a revolution Christianity wrought amongst children in the Greco-Roman world. They were at the bottom of the heap. An expositio was its worst manifestation. Particularly if you had a little girl, you left her out for somebody to pick up, and often trafficked then into prostitution. And you were able to do that. And he said, and Christians came along, and Christians said no to abortion, and they began to honour the body and the sacredness of the body, and they loved their kids, and they brought them to be baptised or to be dedicated, because they remembered that Jesus said, bring the kids to me. And they remembered how God's anger burned against child sacrifice, and they developed a notion of human made in the image of God, dignified, valuable, a body that what we do with it is so important. And they remember that Paul said, honour God with your body. What you do with your body has repercussions for your life, but for all of us. And let's live in ways that build the common good. And Backer's argument is that the early pagans, in the end, looked at this, these ways of life, and in the end they liked what they saw. And they were, it made them think, and it made them stop, you see. So I think we're on the threshold of a better story here that grows out of a critique of the sexual revolution in terms of its own failed promises. And I think as we're saying over here, maybe this will suddenly, the opportunity here for us will come much quicker than we think. You know, with Trump and stuff, that things suddenly can change so quickly in our culture that people are beginning to say, what's the end game here? Where's this taking us? And maybe there's a bigger opportunity here for us than we can begin to imagine. So what's the story we're going to tell in our congregations? You know, I'd suggest individual stories are really quite important. That's why I told the story about Ed. I'm so lucky. I can, you know, people talking about, say, the same-sex issue, and I say, hang on, you're talking as if I've not met anybody. I say, my pastor's gay. He wouldn't use that as a noun, but it might be used of him as a verb, that he's same-sex attracted. He's certainly shared that with all of us, and it's been a huge kind of help to lots of us in all kinds of ways. So we've got members of our fellowship who are same-sex attracted, and he's my pastor, and you don't need to say anything more, because what they'll want to know, you see, is what does he get up to? What does that mean? But you don't need to say anything more, because you've just broken the narrative, which is that you don't know anything about these stories out there. But you see, you tell your own stories. There's my, that's where we are. So we're on the same ground here. So we do need individual stories. We need our own story. We need to tell our own story of how, you know, the sexual revolution shook us. I'll be quite honest, it shakes me. It shook me. And it caused me to doubt. And I think some of us it does. It, tell that story. But you can say, but when I began to look at some of the data, and when I began to, you know, with a hard head, say, hang on, my culture sells us so much stuff. Are we being sold something here? When I began to look at some of the data, and then I remembered how, how the Lord treated kids, and I realised we need to think about justice and equality in a different way, because what our culture doesn't do is it doesn't have a language in which those principles, values, are used to build the common good. And that's what we think marriage is, just a great and the biblical view of marriage and all the virtues that accompany it does. So those are those individual stories, but of course we want it to those to be rooted in a bigger narrative. What is our story? And I haven't actually got, you know, I don't think what I've got is all that great, but I'm not bothered about that, because I think we've all got to get our thinking caps on. The best story is going to be your story, something that's moved your heart, it's inspired you. People don't want a list of facts that you picked up. It's got to get into your heart, this, because they've got a sense that you believe this. So what is the story? Well, I think our story begins once upon a time. But we'd say, but our story doesn't begin once upon a time, there was me. That isn't our story. It's a completely different lens, actually. Our story is once upon a time there was God. And that he is there. And he's not silent. And that we don't go through life having to make it up as we go along, but that the creator and designer of the world has spoken. So our story is that it doesn't begin with us, it begins with God. And it begins with a God actually who's not silent, who speaks. And what we found when we listened was two big things. First of all, he reveals himself. So we're about Christmas to talk about his revelation of himself. The Word became flesh, dwelt amongst us. And that's life for the world. But there's something else. He not only revealed who he is, he reveals who we are. Made in the image of God, male and female, he made them. He said, be fruitful and rule and govern over my world. And for us, being made in the image of God is just so rich an idea, it almost makes our minds explode. Because what it means is that God says to us, rule my world as I rule creation. I place you on this earth to rule and govern. And so when I switch on my computer in the morning, or when I sweep the street, or when I close the door, I'm expressing my image. I'm being in the image of God as he is. And more than that, God says, love one another as I love you as well. Express my image. And in this special relationship that we Christians call marriage, we find ourselves, when we love in that way, we are loving just like his, because his love is always intense and passionate. He follows you, he wants us. But it's also faithful. It's not a one-night stand. He won't fall in love with his secretary. He won't move on in a few years later. And so for us, God's written something really important into our humanity, in the gift of marriage, this thing we call one fleshness. It actually is a picture of God himself. And when we live like that, we believe we're actually like him. And this gives us some good news, we think, in three areas. First of all, it gives us a different story about this whole area of human identity that we're struggling with today. It's the greatest apologetics opportunity here for us, identity. Because as a result of what we hear from God about who he is, but then who we are, we don't believe we're consigned to this cul-de-sac of self-construction. We don't believe that. And I know it sounds attractive, I identify as, but all these social science and psychological evidence stacks up to say it's a cul-de-sac. It doesn't. It's hard to make yourself up. So for us, I've lost my slides there. So for us, about identity, for us it's not discovering yourself, It's revealed to the self. The contours of who we are made in the image of God, male and female, is revealed to us. And there's an intrinsic, an implicit agenda in that, to govern as he governs, to love as he loves. And that's what gives shape and purpose to our lives. Second, we have a story, we believe, about what it means to really flourish as human beings. We agree, we share with the sexual revolution its aim to see people do better. The sexual revolution is never sold as a way of driving people down. No one wants to make people smaller. And so we say we share that. We've got the same vision for human flourishing, but we see things differently again. If we can, you see, and then at this point I might tell a story again. It might be about someone in my family. I'm not going to do it here because it's recorded. But I might say, I know a little guy, you know, and I know people like Krish Kandaya with his Home for Good movement. It's about going and giving a home to kids who nobody wanted, you know. And I see this as a fallout from the sexual revolution. So for us, these important principles of what it means to flourish, it's got to work for them. And we may disagree over this, but what I think what I want to ask you to do is to allow me the space to say, for us, equality, justice and freedom is about the weakest and most vulnerable, and it's our kids. And we think this way of living our lives brings a kind of a flourishing to them. And also it brings a flourishing to us, because we believe flourishing, when we boundary what we want, builds moral capital, yes, but also when we sacrifice ourselves for this common good, it actually brings flourishing to us. And you can say, I know in today's culture, that's kind of like blasphemous to say self-denial. It's actually at the front of our faith. If any man follows me, take up a cross, you know. It's front and square there in our faith, but it's always understood rightly as the means to flourishing in the end, life abundant. And this may sound like double Dutch, but to us it's life for the world. We really believe this. Our problem is we don't believe it ourselves at times. That's when people smell our fear and our uncertainty. And we find it hard to talk about self-denial. And I think when Ed quite rightly says, well, you know, I'm happy to come up and talk about my sex life again, which is what you ask me to do all the time. Wheel me out. You know. And you all say, thank you very much for this great sacrifice you're making in your chastity to honour marriage as you do. Thank you so much, you know. But he rightly says, what about you? You know, we began to go easy on divorce, didn't we, in our culture, decades ago. These hot button issues are just the downstream outworking of our losing our anchorage in the Christian moral vision that Jesus insisted on. And so what about you? This is as much about rethinking divorce. And I know we could spend a couple of days on this one, but we need to rethink it, that's for sure. It's about us being ready to be a bit more open ourselves about our sex lives, about our longings, our desires, and bringing up our children differently. But we believe that in the end, if we do that, if we embrace this called self-denial, because Jesus promised about flourishing. So we've got a better story about flourishing. We share the goal, but we think you get there a different way, and actually it looks quite different when you get there. So you can do that with a smile on your face. You're not driving anybody down. You're saying, we're all for flourishing, you see. We're with you, but we just think it's a different route. Finally, I think we have a better story about our erotic longings, which brings us right back, doesn't it? Longing, desiring sits at the core of what we are as human beings. We want stuff. We come into the world, we're not simply evaluators. We don't sit there and evaluate the world like computers. Our arms reach out, we want, we grasp, we're desiring, we want to make a difference. We're desiring creatures. And of course, what we find very early on, if with a baby, even in the first 24 hours, if you look at the kind of objects, their eyes and their seeing is pretty blurry, but nice experiments where you look, what kind of objects do their eyes tend to follow? Is it triangles and squares? Or is it objects with two dots and a smiley thing? They are precognitive. They have no language. There's very little conceptual structure. But kids come into the world primed. Their way of being in the world is already primed for a relationship. And of course, at one level, in evolutionary terms, that enables the bonding to take place that's so important. But we as Christians would see in that, we'd say, don't just look into that phenomenon, look along it. Where is it pointing? As Augustine said, our hearts are restless for a relationship until they find their rest in thee. We know that. We know that every human relationship, in the end, you look into it, but look along it. What is it telling us about our desiring, our wanting to love and to be loved? It's telling us that I'll only be consummated in God. Which brings us back to our erotic longings, which are some of the most zingy, powerful kinds of wanting, isn't it? Longing. It's embodied in a way that's hard to resist. You just feel it, the pull's there. The erection happens, the sense of arousal's already underway. You don't think it happens, it's the way we are. Now, what the question is, where does that kind of longing figure in the redemptive narrative? Is God redeeming that at all? What's he doing with it? Where does it fit in terms of the new creation that we all believe in? And what we tend to do is, we Hugh Schrader, that's the bit the devil slapped on, you see. And so we're brought up in shame about those feelings from their first, earliest, I remember as a little boy, first earliest arousal, those feelings, dirty. Dirty. And the reason one or two of us are feeling a little bit uncomfortable because we're thinking, he's not going to get on, I'm sounding a bit like kind of sex with God we're heading in the direction of here. The reason you're feeling that is precisely because of that. Because sex somehow belongs outside the story of God. You see? But the question is, do we have a story about this? We've got to have a story about this longing. And Christopher West, a Catholic theologian who's done some wonderful work, he gave a talk in London recently, and it was just great to see Lee Gatiss of the Church Society and Reform and all these people eating out of the hands of this Catholic theologian. It was quite delicious, as we all were. But he told a great story, and I want to tell it again here, because he said a Catholic priest went out for a walk one night. Now, what had happened a little earlier was that a couple had stumbled into the area and started to be amorous and then began to make love, and it was a starlit night, clear sky. And they made love under the stars. And he happened to be on his prayer walk, and they were making love precisely on his little path. So it was dark, and he kind of stumbled onto them. And he pulled back, and then they're very embarrassed, and they start to, you know, tuck themselves in and stuff. He said, no, don't, please don't. The only thing I want to say before I go, and it's just this question I want to ask you, is what is happening here between you two? And he looks up at the stars and says, what's it got to do with the stars? That's all. What's it got to do with eternity? With God? With our calling? with where all human history is heading? And the answer is that these erotic longings tell the story of where all human history is heading in our very bodies. They tell us that it's going to head in the direction of the end of history, which is the marriage supper of the Lamb. It's what we believe, isn't it? All human history is ending to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And our erotic longings point there. And we're going to have sex in heaven because there'll be no marriage or given marriage between human beings. But our most bodily longings will be satisfied in him, as they're never fully satisfied in the hottest sex life you can have on this earth. There's always something dissatisfying because our hearts are restless, including our erotic longings, restless, till they find their rest in thee. So marriage itself becomes one of the great through thoughts of the Bible. It starts with a wedding in a garden and ends with a wedding in heaven. And, of course, one of the metaphors in between, one of the great through thoughts to describe God's relationship with us is marriage. And God describes his way, his love for us in lots of ways, you know, mother bear for a cub and so on. But the commonest, probably, the great theme through Scripture is marriage. He wants to marry us, to have us, to love us faithfully, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, till death us do part into all eternity. And he's etched that story into our humanity, so that when a man and a woman get married, you are putting on display the glory of the gospel. Will you take her for richer, for poorer? Because God's like that. Because we iconize, we inhabit the image of God in this wonderful thing. And of course, what we want to say then is, but where does that leave the single person? Where it leaves the single person is that you don't have to do something to honor it. Do you? What a single person does in their chastity is they honor marriage in the same way that someone who keeps their promises within marriage honors marriage. So the married man says, things are rough at home, we've got some issues, but I'm not going to have an affair with my secretary. Or the woman in her 50s, thankfully, you know, the last kid's gone home, here's my chance to get rid of this boring man. As many women do now. You know, the rates of divorce, initiation and older. It's women. Can't blame them. Fed up. And a Christian woman says, that is not my option. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, for boring and interesting. That is the call, the claim of God. And when we honour that promise, we put on display the kind of love that God has. Because he finds us pretty boring at times. I guess. So, the single person, when I had a woman came up to me, and she was kind of in tears at the end one day after asking about this, she said, what you said about singleness helped me see that I'm sexual, that I could have had lots of affairs, but what I simply said was the single person who is chaste, who doesn't do one-night stands, is putting on display to the world the fact that God doesn't do that. That his love is always bounded, covenantal. Passion is fused with covenant. And the single person honors that in their chastity, in their own body. And so they're not asexual. I say what we're doing with your sexuality as a single person is you're discipling it in a way that honors the marriage supper of the Lamb. And in a way, you're ahead of the game, because in heaven there'll be no giving in marriage between people. Why? Not because there's no marriage in heaven, but because there's one marriage in heaven between Christ and his people. And you as a single person, a chaste person, point forward to a way that we'll all be. So what we've got to do, and because we're word people, it's a bit like communion sometimes. We don't know what to do with these physical, bodily images of things because we're used to rows of words. But remember that Jesus spoke words in ways that fire the imagination, as communion is given to fire the imagination. And as marriage is given, I'm not getting into sacramentalism here, but as marriage is given also to fire imagination. So I say to people, why are weddings, we've got a wonderful opportunity here to rethink weddings. Why do we ape middle class values? We parade our women in and some oafs talk about how pretty the bridesmaids are. You know, and these are beautiful women made in the image of God. That two people, a man and a woman, being brought together. God's marrying them. This is his work. We're at a sacred occasion. It's not just an evangelistic event that we've got you all here for, you relatives. Just as an event. What is happening here puts on display what we want you to hear. And so we've got some wonderful opportunities, I think, to rethink how we do weddings, how we do courtship. No other minority group leaves the mating of its own people to chance like we do. Orthodox Jews don't. They don't leave their young people to just make it up as they go along. They expect them to marry. There's an expectation of marriage, or as we would say, unchaste singleness, because in our culture. But we talk of these things and we help and encourage people. Lots of opportunities here to be really radical, I think, so that we can get ourselves in shape when things do turn in our culture, not just to tell them what it is, but to show them what it is. Communities, strong marriages, strong families, single people who have a theological role within this human flourishing, working for the common good. That put the gospel on display in all kinds of ways. So I'm going to stop and just get in lots of pushback and come back there. But I just want to finish with this last thought. What this is calling us to do, I suggest, those of us who are pastors, is to build communities of what I call radical hospitality. You want your churches to be full of interesting people from all kinds of family structures, backgrounds, transgender, same-sex, threesomes, who knows what's coming down the line. Don't you want your church, how its door open to those? Because in your church you say, look, this is our blueprint, this high teaching of marriage that Jesus gives. We believe that everything, all sexual activity outside of this way of life is fall short of God's best. We call it sin. That's our blueprint. But you know, there's not a person in this church who quite lives up to all that this calls. The husbands here, they're not doing what's involved, what God calls them to as far. The wives, and we're all struggling with this blueprint. So welcome aboard. This is a place for strugglers. Please come. We want to serve you, no matter who you, what your family structure, what your sexuality. We want to serve you. But just do not ask us to give up our blueprint. Because we won't. Because this is life for the world. And we're going to struggle to keep working it out. Which means that if you can't sign up to it, you can't be a leader here. Obviously, or a home group leader. Because it's about signing up to the blueprint. But please let us, if you can't at the moment, please let us serve you. Whatever you look like, wherever you come from, regardless of your sexuality, please let us serve you. But we will never give up our blueprint because this, and here we use the language of our culture, is who we are. It's who we are, Christians. And it all might seem a bit of a, you'd say, oh dear me, yeah, there's that, but then there's the reality of my people. But I think, you know, we have been here before, 2,000 years ago. The belief that Jesus had been raised from the dead inspired just small groups of ordinary people like us, like your people, often persecuted. But the belief that Jesus had been raised from the dead inspired them to create communities a culture that was so attractive to pagans in the end, the way they treated women, children, sexually exploited, slaves, poor. By the end of the 4th century, an entire empire stood on the verge of faith. And we believe the gospel's life for the world. And I think the sexual revolution is giving us an opportunity now, amongst other things, to say, and we don't just tell it, we show the world again what this looks like, to tell the story all over again.